knowing what was happening at Devon's, begged for advice. Park and Williams were experts on vaccine therapy. Even during the polio epidemics, they had done excellent science, if only to prove the negative. Park had tried to develop, but instead proved the ineffectiveness of several treatments. This time, they felt hopeful. Their work with streptococci and pneumococci, like that of the Rockefeller Institutes, was promising. But as yet, Park and Williams had no advice to give. They could only swab the throats and nasal passages of the sick at Upton, return to their laboratory, and proceed from there. They also got material from another source, which Williams never forgot. It was her first influenza autopsy. The body was that of, she later wrote, a fine-looking youth from Texas, who shared her last name. She stood staring at his fine features, wondering about him, wondering even if he was some distant relative, and noting, death occurring so quickly, it left little or no marks of disease anywhere except for the lungs. She could not have looked at his perfect form, perfect but for death, and not wondered just what the country was about to endure. The drive back to New York, the car filled with swabbings from mucosal membranes, sputum, and tissue samples of a mysterious and lethal disease, likely alternated between intense conversation and silence. Conversation as they planned their experiments, and silence, knowing the silence of the laboratory that awaited them. There was, in fact, nothing like Park's laboratory in the world. From outside on the street, Park could look up with pride on the six-story building, the floors of laboratories, knowing that his successes had built them. Entirely dedicated to diagnostic testing, production of sera and antitoxins, and medical research, his creation sat at the foot of East 16th Street with the teeming wharfs of the East River just beyond. Streetcars, horse-drawn carriages and automobiles clattered past, and the smell of manure still mixed with that of gasoline and oil. There was all the sweat and ambition and failure and grit and money of New York City, all that made the city what it was and is. Inside the building, Park oversaw a virtual industry. More than 200 workers reported to him, nearly half of them scientists or technicians in one laboratory or another, each one with lab tables laid out in horizontal rows, gas burners in virtually constant use on each table, glassware stacked on shelves above the tables, as well as filling shelves along the walls, the rooms often hissing with steam and humidity from the autoclaves used to sterilize. No other laboratory anywhere, not in any institute, not in any university, not sponsored by any government, not run by any pharmaceutical company, had the combination of scientific competence, epidemiological and public health expertise, and ability to carry out directed research. To focus all resources on one question and not be deflected from that search, no matter how enticing or important a finding might be, intent on immediate practical results. His laboratory could also function in extreme crisis. It had done so before, preventing outbreaks of cholera and typhoid, triumphing over diphtheria, helping in meningitis epidemics. It had done so not only in New York City, but all over the country. When requested, Park had sent teams to fight outbreaks of disease elsewhere. And one other ability made the department unique. If a solution was found, it could produce serum and vaccines in industrial quantities as quickly as, and of better quality than, any drug manufacturer in the world. Indeed, it had been so successful making antitoxins that drug makers and city physicians had combined to use all their political power to limit that production. But now Park could quickly gear back up. Because of the assignment to produce serum for the army, he had just quadrupled the number of horses he could infect and then bleed. So it was not surprising that soon after Park returned from Camp Upton, he received a telegram from Richard Pierce, head of the National Research Council's Section on Medicine. Pierce was grabbing at any information he could get from the French, the British, even the Germans, and distributing it to investigators everywhere. He was also breaking the questions about influenza into pieces and asking each of a handful of investigators to focus on a single piece. From Park, he wanted to know the nature of the agent causing the so-called Spanish influenza, and pure cultures of the causative organism, if obtainable. Will your lab undertake the necessary bacteriological studies and make reports as quickly as possible to the undersigned? Park instantly wired back, "Will undertake work." It was as if the laboratory had gone to war, and Park was confident of victory. As he reviewed every published and unpublished scrap of data on the disease from laboratories around the world, he was unimpressed and dismissed most of it with near contempt. Certain his lab could do better, believing that others' sloppiness at least partly contributed to their failure to understand the disease, he laid extraordinarily ambitious plans. In addition to finding the pathogen, in addition to finding a vaccine or serum or both, in addition to producing that drug in huge quantities, in addition to communicating to others the precise procedures to follow so they could produce it, he intended still more. He intended to make the most thorough study of any disease outbreak ever, selecting a large sample of people and, as many of them inevitably became ill, monitoring them through the most sophisticated possible laboratory and epidemiological means. The workload would be enormous, but he believed that his department could handle it. But within days, almost within hours, the disease began to overwhelm the department. Park had already compensated for the loss of labor to the war by analyzing every system and maximizing efficiency, installing, for example, a vacuum pump that in 15 minutes could fill 3,000 tubes with individual vaccine doses, and even changing accounting methods. But now, as influenza struck first one janitor or technician or scientist at a time, then four at a time, then 15 at a time, the laboratory reeled. Not so long before, when the health department had tracked a typhus outbreak to ground, four of his workers had died of typhus, most likely from laboratory infection. Now people in Park's own lab were again sick, some dying. Influenza had humbled him, and quickly. He abandoned both his arrogance about the work of others and his own ambitious plans. Now he was trying to get just one thing right, the important thing. What was the pathogen? Meanwhile, the world seemed to shift underfoot. To Park and Williams and to others in other laboratories racing to find an answer, it must have seemed as if they could see this great catastrophe approaching, but had to remain frozen in place, all but incapable of doing anything to defeat or avoid it. It was almost as if one's foot were caught under rocks in a tidal pool while the tide came in, the water rising to the knees, to the waist, one sucking in a deep breath, then doubling over to try to pry one's foot loose and straightening to feel the water at one's neck, the swell of a wave passing over one's head. New York City was panicking, terrified. By now, Copeland was enforcing strict quarantines on all cases. There were literally hundreds of thousands of people sick simultaneously, many of them desperately sick. The death toll ultimately reached 33,000 for New York City alone, and that understated the number considerably, since statisticians later arbitrarily stopped counting people as victims of the epidemic, even though people were still dying of the disease at epidemic rates. Still dying months later at rates higher than anywhere else in the country. It was impossible to get a doctor, and perhaps more impossible to get a nurse. Reports came in that nurses were being held by force in the homes of patients too frightened and desperate to allow them to leave. Nurses were literally being kidnapped. It did not seem possible to put more pressure on the laboratory. Yet more pressure came. The pressure pushed Park to abandon more than his ambitious plans. He had always been meticulous, had never compromised, had built much of his scientific reputation on exposing the flawed work of others, always moving forward carefully, basing his own experiments upon well-established premises and with as few assumptions as possible. On the basis of experimental facts, he had always said, we are justified in... Now Park had no leisure for justification. If he was to have any impact on the course of the epidemic, he would have to guess, and guess right. So those in his laboratory would, he reported, study closely only the more dominant types that were demonstrated by our procedure. We recognized that our methods did not take into account heretofore undescribed organisms that might have an etiologic relationship to these infections. The laboratory had only two constants. One was an endless supply of samples, of swabbings, blood, sputum, and urine from live patients, and organs from the dead. We had plenty of material, I am sorry to say, Williams observed laconically. And they had their routine. Only the need to keep to discipline saved the laboratory from utter chaos. There was nothing even faintly exciting about this work. It was pure tedium and pure boredom. And yet every step involved contact with something that could kill, and every step involved passion. Technicians took sputum samples from patients in the hospital and immediately. They could not wait even an hour, or bacteria from the patient's mouth could penetrate into the sputum and contaminate it, began working with it. The steps began with washing, placing each small lump of bald mucus in a bottle of sterile water, removing it and repeating the process 5 times, then breaking up the mucus, washing it more, passing a platinum loop, a thin circle of platinum, like something one uses to blow bubbles, through it to transfer it to a test tube, taking another loop and repeating the step 6 times. Each step took time. Time while people died. But they had no choice. They needed each step. Needed to dilute the bacteria to prevent too many colonies from growing in the same medium. Then they took more time, more steps, isolating each of these growths. Everything mattered. The most tedious tasks mattered. Washing glassware mattered. Contaminated glassware could ruin an experiment, waste time, cost lives. In the course of this work, 220,488 test tubes, bottles, and flasks would be sterilized. Everything mattered, and yet no one knew who would report to work each day, who would not, and who would suddenly be carried across the street to the hospital. And if someone failed to come into work, it was nearly impossible to keep track of such simple jobs as removing growing cultures from incubators. There were dozens of ways to grow bacteria, but often only one way to grow a particular kind. Some grow only without oxygen, others only with it in plentiful supply. Some require alkaline media, others acid. Some are extremely delicate, others stable. Every step, every attempt to grow the pathogen meant effort, and effort meant time. Every hour incubating a culture meant time. They did not have time. 4 days after accepting the task from Pierce, Park wired, "The only results so far that are of real importance have been obtained in 2 fatal cases. One, a man coming from Brooklyn Navy Yard, and one, a doctor from the Naval Hospital in Boston. Both developed an acute septic pneumonia and died within a week of the onset of the first infection. In both cases, the lungs showed a beginning pneumonia, and in smears, very abundant streptococci. There were absolutely no influenza bacilli in either of the lungs." The failure to find the influenza bacillus maddened Park. His best hope to produce a vaccine or serum would be to find a known pathogen, and the most likely suspect was the one Pfeiffer had named Bacillus influenzae. Pfeiffer had been and still was confident it caused the disease. Park would not hesitate to rule B. influenzae out if he did not find good evidence for it, but he had the utmost respect for Pfeiffer. Working in these desperate circumstances, he wanted to confirm rather than reject Pfeiffer's work. He wanted the answer to be Pfeiffer's bacillus. That would give them a chance to produce something that saved thousands of lives. B. influenzae was a particularly difficult bacteria to isolate. It is tiny, even by the standards of bacteria, and usually occurs singly or in pairs rather than in large groups. It requires particular factors, including blood, in culture medium for it to grow. It grows only within a very narrow range of temperatures, and its colonies are minute, transparent, and without structure. Most bacteria form distinctive colonies with a particular shape and color, distinctive enough that they can sometimes be identified just by looking at the colony in the same way that some ants can be identified by the form of their anthill. B. influenzae grows only on the surface of the medium, since it depends heavily upon oxygen. It is also difficult to stain, hence difficult to see under the microscope. It is an easy target to miss unless one is specifically looking for it, and unless one uses excellent technique. While others in the lab searched for other organisms, Park asked Anna Williams to concentrate on finding fifers. Anna Williams found it. She found it constantly. Ultimately, once she perfected her technique, she would find it in 80% of all samples from the Willard Parker Hospital, in every single sample from the Marine Hospital, in 98% of the samples from the Home for Children. As much as Park wanted Williams to be right, he would not let his desire corrupt his science. He went a step further, to the most delicate test of identity, agglutination. Agglutination refers to a phenomenon in which antibodies in a test tube bind to the antigen of the bacterium and form clumps, often large enough to be visible to the naked eye. Since the binding of antibodies to an antigen is specific, since the antibodies to the influenza bacillus will bind to only that bacterium and to no other, it is a precise confirmation of identity. The agglutination tests proved without doubt that Williams had found Pfeiffer's influenza bacillus. Less than a week after first reporting his failure to find it, Park wired Pierce that B. influenzae would seem to be the starting point of the disease. But he was well aware that his methods had been less than thorough, adding, "There is, of course, the possibility that some unknown filterable virus may be the starting point." The report had consequences. Park's laboratory began the struggle to produce an antiserum and vaccine to Pfeiffer's bacillus. Soon they were culturing liters and liters of the bacteria, transporting it north and injecting it into the horses on the health department's 175-acre farm 65 miles north of the city. But the only way to know for certain that B. influenzae caused the disease was to follow Koch's postulates. Isolate the pathogen. Use it to recreate the disease in an experimental animal, and then re-isolate the pathogen from the animal. The bacillus did kill laboratory rats, but their symptoms did not resemble influenza. The results, suggestive as they were, did not fully satisfy Koch's postulates. In this case, the necessary experimental animal was man. Human experiments had begun. In Boston, Rosenau and Keegan were already trying to give the disease to volunteers from a Navy brig. None of the volunteer subjects had yet gotten sick. One of the doctors conducting the study did. In fact, he died of influenza. In a scientific sense, however, his death demonstrated nothing. Chapter 24. While Park tried to produce an antiserum or vaccine against the disease in New York, Philadelphia was already approaching collapse. Its experience would soon be echoed in many cities around the country. There, Paul Lewis was searching for the answer as well. Few, including Park, were more likely to find it. The son of a physician, Lewis grew up in Milwaukee, went to the University of Wisconsin, and finished his medical training at Penn in 1904. Even before leaving medical school, he knew he intended to spend his life in the laboratory, and he quickly acquired both a pedigree and a well-deserved reputation. He started as a junior investigator working on pneumonia under Welch, Osler, Biggs, and several others who comprised the Rockefeller Institute's Board of Scientific Advisors. Lewis impressed them all. Most impressed was Theobald Smith, one of the world's leading bacteriologists, for whom Lewis then worked in Boston. Later, Smith recommended Lewis to Simon Flexner, saying that Harvard lacked the resources to allow Lewis to develop fully and that his heart lies in research. From Smith, there could come no higher compliment. Lewis deserved it. He seemed born for the laboratory. At least that was the only place where he was happy. He loved not only the work itself, but the laboratory environment. Loved disappearing into the laboratory and into thought. Love was not too strong a word. His passions lay in the lab. At Rockefeller, Lewis had started off pursuing his own ideas, but when a polio epidemic erupted, Flexner asked him to work with him on it. He agreed. It was a perfect match. Their polio work was a model combination of speed and good science. They not only proved that polio was a viral disease, still considered a landmark finding in virology, but they developed a vaccine that protected monkeys from polio 100% of the time. It would take nearly half a century to develop a polio vaccine for humans. In the course of this research, Lewis became one of the leading experts in the world on viruses. Flexner pronounced Lewis one of the best men in the country, a very gifted fellow. That may have been an understatement. Richard Shope worked closely with him in the 1920s, knew many of the world's best scientists, including Flexner, Welch, Park, Williams, and many Nobel laureates, and himself became a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He called Lewis the smartest man he ever knew. Joseph Aronson, a prize-winning University of Pennsylvania scientist who had also done research at the Pasteur Institute, named his son after Lewis and, like Shope, said Lewis was the brightest man he had ever met. When the war began, Pierce, the National Research Council official, told Lewis what he told only four or five other scientists in the country, to expect to be asked for special service in connection with epidemic disease. Lewis was ready. He received a Navy commission and told Flexner he had no onerous routine duties. His laboratory abilities were far more important. He was still cooperating with Cole and Avery on the development of pneumonia serum, and he was also, as he told Flexner, experimenting with dyes as regards their capacity to inhibit the growth of the bacteria that caused tuberculosis. The idea that dyes might kill bacteria was not original with him, but he was doing world-class work in the area, and his instincts were right about its importance. 20 years later, a Nobel Prize would go to Gerhard Domack for turning a dye into the first antibiotic, the first of the sulfa drugs. But now the city did not need laboratory breakthroughs that deepened understanding. It needed instant successes. Lewis had reached his conclusions about polio with tremendous speed, roughly a year, and they had been both sound and pioneering conclusions. But now he had only weeks, even days. Now he was watching bodies literally pile up in the hospital morgue at the Navy Yard, in the morgues of civilian hospitals, in undertaking establishments, in homes. He remembered Flexner's work on meningitis during an epidemic of that disease. Flexner had solved that problem, and the success had made the reputation of the Rockefeller Institute. Knowing that Flexner had succeeded then made a solution to this seem possible. Perhaps Lewis could do the same. He considered whether a filter-passing organism caused influenza. But to look for a virus, Lewis would have to look in darkness. That was science, the best of science. At least to look into the gloaming was, but he was not now engaged only in science. Not right now. He was trying to save lives now. He had to look where there was light. First, light shone on a kind of blunt force use of the immune system. Even if they could not find the pathogen, even if they could not follow normal procedures and infect horses with the pathogen and then prepare the blood from horses, there was one animal that was suffering from the disease that was scorching its way across the earth. That animal was man. Most people who contracted the disease survived. Even most people who contracted pneumonia survived. It was quite possible that their blood and their serum held antibodies that would cure or prevent disease in others. Lewis and Flexner had had some success using this approach with polio in 1910. In Boston, Dr. W.R. Redden at the Navy Hospital also remembered, as he reported, the experimental evidence presented by Flexner and Lewis with convalescent serum from poliomyelitis. Now Redden and a colleague drew blood from those who had survived an influenza attack, extracted the serum, and injected it into 36 pneumonia patients in a row, beginning October 1st. This was not a scientific experiment with controls, and in a scientific sense, the results proved nothing. But by the time they reported the results in the October 19th JAMA, 30 patients had recovered. Five were still undergoing treatment, and only one had died. Experiments began in Philadelphia using both the whole blood and serum of survivors of influenza as well. These, too, were not scientific experiments. They were desperate attempts to save lives. If there was any sign this procedure worked, the science could follow later. Lewis let others conduct that blunt force work. It took no truly special skills, and others could do it as well as he. He spent his time on four things. He did not do these things sequentially. He did them simultaneously, moving down different paths, setting up experiments to test each hypothesis at the same time. First, he tried to develop an influenza vaccine using the same methods he had used against polio. This was a more sophisticated version of the blunt force approach of transfusing the blood or serum of influenza survivors, for he at least suspected a virus might cause influenza. Second, he stayed in the laboratory following a shimmer of light. As Park had reasoned, so Lewis reasoned. Research could find bacteria. Pfeiffer had already pointed an accusing finger at one bacillus. Lewis and everyone in his laboratories were working hours and days without relief, taking only a few hours off for sleep, running procedure after procedure, agglutination, filtration, transferring culture growths, injecting laboratory animals. His team, too, searched for bacteria. They took more swabs from the throats and noses of the first victims, exposed the medium to it, and waited. They worked intensively, 24 hours a day in shifts, and then they waited, frustrated by the time it took bacteria to grow in the cultures, frustrated by the number of cultures that became contaminated, frustrated by everything that interfered with their progress. In the first 15 cases, Lewis found no B. influenzae. Ironically, the disease had exploded so quickly, spreading to hospital staff, that Lewis had little except sputum samples to work with. The hospitals were so depleted of staff, I have had no autopsy material, except from four badly decomposed bodies, almost certainly too long dead to be of any use. Then, like Park and Williams, Lewis adjusted his techniques and did begin to find the bacillus regularly. He gave this information to Crewson, the health commissioner. The Inquirer and other newspapers, desperate to say something positive, declared that he had found the cause of influenza and armed the medical profession with absolute knowledge on which to base their campaign against the disease. Lewis had no such absolute knowledge, nor did he believe he had it. True, he had isolated B. influenzae, but he had also isolated a pneumococcus and a hemolytic streptococcus. Some instinct pointed him another direction. He began third and fourth lines of inquiry. The third involved shifting his dye experiments from trying to kill tuberculosis bacteria to trying to kill pneumococci. But death surrounded him. enveloped him. He turned his attention back to helping produce the only thing that might work now. After the emergency, if anything seemed to work, he could always return to the laboratory and do careful, deliberate experimentation to understand it and prove its effectiveness. So he chose as his targets the bacteria he and others had found. From the first instant he had seen the dying sailors, he had known he would have to begin work on it now. For even if he had guessed right, even if what he was doing could succeed, it would take time to succeed. So, in his laboratory and in other laboratories around the city, the investigators no longer investigated. They simply tried to produce. There was no certainty that anything they produced would work. There was only hope. He started by preparing medium using beef peptone broth with blood added, and then growing cultures of the pathogens they had isolated from cases. B. influenzae, types 1 and 2 of the pneumococcus, and hemolytic streptococcus. He personally prepared small batches of vaccine including these organisms and gave it to 60 people. Of those 60, only 3 people developed pneumonia and none died. A control group had 10 pneumonias and 3 deaths. This seemed more than just promising. It was not proof. Many factors could explain the results, including random chance. But he could not wait for explanations. His laboratory had no ability to produce the immense quantities of vaccine needed. It required an industrial operation. They needed vats to grow these things in, not petri dishes or laboratory flasks. They needed vats like those in a brewery. He handed off this task to others in the city, including those who ran the municipal laboratory. It would take time to grow enough for tens of thousands of people. The whole process, even in its most accelerated state, would take at least 3 weeks. And it would take time once they made the vaccine to administer it to thousands and thousands of people in a series of injections of increasing doses spaced several days apart. In all that time, the disease would be killing. Meanwhile, Lewis began work on still a fifth line of inquiry, making a serum that could cure the disease. This work was trickier. They could make a vaccine with a shotgun approach, combining several organisms and protecting against all of them. Today, vaccines against diphtheria, pertussis, whooping cough, and tetanus are combined in a single shot. A single shot protecting against measles, mumps, and rubella is routinely given to children. And today's flu shots contain vaccines against several subtypes of influenza viruses, while the anti-pneumonia vaccine is a direct descendant of the work done at the Rockefeller Institute in 1917. A serum had to aim at only one specific target. If it worked at all, it would work only against a single organism. To make a serum that worked, Lewis would have to pick a single target. If he had to aim at a single target, he had to choose the bacillus Pfeiffer had discovered, B. influenzae. It was still by far the most likely cause of the disease. Developing a serum against this organism would likely be difficult. While Lewis was still at the Rockefeller Institute, Flexner himself had tried to do this in collaboration with Martha Wallstein. Wallstein, a fine scientist, although Flexner never treated her with the respect he gave to others, had experimented with B. influenzae almost continuously since 1906. But Flexner and she had made no progress whatsoever. They had not only failed to develop a serum that could help man, they had failed to cure any laboratory animals. Lewis never understood precisely where Flexner had gone wrong in that attempt, although it certainly would have been the subject of many talks in the famous lunchroom where solutions to so many scientific problems were suggested. Now, he had no opportunity to think deeply about the problem, think all the way through it, come up with a hypothesis with explanatory power, and test it. Lewis could only hope that Flexner failed because his technique was faulty. That was quite possible. Flexner had sometimes been a little sloppy in the laboratory. He had once even conceded, Technically, I am not well trained in the sense of meticulous and complete accuracy. So now Lewis hoped some technical error, perhaps in the preparation of the medium, perhaps in too rough a usage for the killed bacteria, perhaps somewhere else, accounted for Flexner's problems. It might have. For example, many years later, a young graduate student entered a laboratory and saw a renowned Harvard professor at the sink washing glassware while his technician was performing a complex task at the workbench. The student asked him why the technician was not washing the glassware. "Because," the professor replied, "I always do the most important part of the experiment, and in this experiment, the most important thing is the cleanliness of the glassware." Lewis turned all his attention, in effect, to washing the glassware, to the most mundane tasks, making certain there would be no mistakes in the work itself, at the same time applying any knowledge about Pfeiffer's bacillus that had been learned since Flexner's failure. Lewis knew full well that little of what he was doing was good science. It was all, or nearly all, based on informed guesswork. He only worked harder. As he worked, the society about him teetered on the edge of collapse. Chapter 25. When Welch had first seen autopsies of victims at Devon's, he had walked out of the morgue and made three calls. To a Harvard pathologist, asking him to conduct further autopsies. To Gorgas's office, warning of the coming of an epidemic. And to Oswald Avery at the Rockefeller Institute, asking him to get on the next train from New York. He hoped Avery could identify the pathogen killing the men at Devon's. Avery immediately left his own lab, walked the few blocks home for a change of clothes, then went to Pennsylvania Station, that magnificent and uplifting building. For the length of his train ride through the Connecticut countryside, through the teeming train stations of New Haven, Providence and Boston, up to Devon's, he began to prepare, reviewing the best approaches to this problem. Welch had told him of his concern that, despite clinical symptoms that looked like influenza, this might be a new disease. Avery's first step would still be to look for the presence of B. influenzae, everyone's chief suspect as the cause of influenza. Avery knew a fair amount about Pfeiffer's bacillus, including that it was exceptionally difficult to grow and that its chemistry made it difficult to stain and hence see in a smear under the microscope. The chemistry and metabolism of the bacteria interested him. He wondered how to make it grow better, how to make it easier to find, how to make it easier to identify. For he always did everything, down to washing the glassware, with precision and discipline. Late that afternoon, Avery arrived at the camp and immediately began laboratory tests. He was all but impervious to the chaos about him, impervious to the bodies of young men lying naked or in bloody sheets he had to step over, as Welch, Cole, Vaughn, Russell, and the others of that party had, to reach the autopsy room. From the first, he encountered difficulties, getting puzzling results from the Gram test. In this test, bacteria are stained with crystal violet, treated with iodine, washed with alcohol, and then stained again with a contrasting dye. Bacteria retaining the violet color are called Gram-positive. Those that do not are Gram-negative. The result of the Gram test is comparable to a witness identifying an assailant as white or black. The answer simply eliminates some possible suspects. Unlike other investigators, Avery found no Gram-negative bacteria. B. influenzae is Gram-negative. The test eliminated B. influenzae as even a possibility. It eliminated all Gram-negative bacteria as possibilities. He repeated the experiment. Again, he found no Gram-negative bacteria. None at all. Avery soon solved this particular puzzle. He discovered that all the liquid in the laboratory bottles labeled alcohol was actually water. Soldiers had apparently drunk the alcohol and replaced it with water. When he got alcohol, the test results came in as expected. He found Gram-negative bacteria. Now he began his hunt in earnest. He began it with dead bodies, those of the men who had died most recently, some of whom so recently that their bodies remained warm to the touch. He felt the soggy sponginess of the still warm lungs and respiratory tract with his gloved hands, seeking out areas of the most obvious infection from which to cut tissue samples, dipping into pockets of pus, seeking the organism responsible for the killing. Perhaps he was a little afraid, this tiny man surrounded by dead young soldiers, but he had courage and he was not hunting rabbits. He had no interest in hunting rabbits. Smears across slides turned up several possible pathogens, all of them potential killers. He needed to know which one did the killing. He stayed at Devon's long enough to grow cultures of bacteria. Like Park and Lewis, Avery had initial difficulty, but began to find Pfeiffer's bacillus. He discovered it in 22 of 30 dead soldiers and gave Welch his results. Meanwhile, Bert Volbach, the Harvard pathologist whom Welch had also asked to help at Devon's, made a stronger statement. Every case showed the influenza bacillus, in many instances pure cultures from one or more lobes. Mixed cultures, usually pneumococcus, where bronchial dilation was marked. Pure cultures of influenza bacillus in the more recent stages, and therefore usually in the upper lobes. In an article in Science, another respected investigator also wrote, "The causative agent is believed to be the bacillus of Pfeiffer." On September 27th, Welch, Cole, and Victor Vaughn wired the Surgeon General from Devon's, "It is established that the influenza at Camp Devon's is caused by the bacillus of Pfeiffer." But it was not so established, at least not to Avery. Although he respected Volbach, not to mention Park, Williams, and Lewis, all of whom were reaching the same conclusion at about the same time, he based conclusions only upon his own findings. And his findings did not convince him yet. In 7 of the autopsies, he found no sign of any bacterial invasion whatsoever, despite the devastation of the lungs. Also, although he found potentially lethal bacteria without any sign of Pfeiffer's in only a single instance, in roughly half the cases he was finding both Pfeiffer's and other organisms, including the pneumococcus, hemolytic streptococcus, and Staphylococcus aureus, which although a lethal organism, rarely caused pneumonia. He could interpret these findings several ways. They might mean that Pfeiffer's B. influenzae did not cause the disease. But that was only one possible conclusion. Pfeiffer's might well be the cause of the disease and, after it infected the victim, other bacteria took advantage of a weakened immune system to follow its lead. This would not be unusual. Finding several pathogens might even actually strengthen the case for Pfeiffer's. Pfeiffer's grew poorly in laboratory cultures whenever other bacteria, especially the pneumococcus or hemolytic streptococcus, were also present. So its existence at all in cultures with these other organisms might indicate that B. influenzae had been present in enormous numbers in the victim. Methodically, he ran through all this in his mind. By early October, he was back at Rockefeller hearing reports from dozens of other investigators around the country and the world that they too were finding the influenza bacillus. But there were also reports of failures to find B. influenzae. It would be easy to dismiss the failures to find it as failures of technique. Pfeiffer's was, after all, one of the most difficult organisms to grow. Still, Avery's own findings alone left too many unanswered questions for him to reach a conclusion, crisis or not. Unlike Park, Williams, and Lewis, Avery was not ready to reach even a tentative conclusion. Yes, Pfeiffer's might cause influenza. Oh yes, it might. But he was not convinced. From Avery came no reports of finding influenza's cause, no phone calls or telegrams that he was sending cultures with which to infect horses and produce serum or vaccine. He was pushing himself harder than he ever had at Devon's, and he always pushed hard. He ate in the laboratory, ran dozens of experiments simultaneously, barely slept, bounced ideas by telephone off Rosenau and others. He bore into his experiments like a drill, breaking them apart and examining every fractured crack in the data for a clue. But if he pushed himself to work, he would not push himself toward a conclusion. He was not convinced. Oswald Avery was different. Pressure troubled him less than having to force the direction of his work, and that he could not pursue the trail wherever it led, could not move at his own pace, could not take the time to think. Make-do solutions were foreign to his nature. He worked on the vertical. He dove deeply into a thing, to the deepest depths, following down the narrowest pathways and into the tiniest openings, leaving no loose ends. In every way, his life was vertical, focused, narrow, controlled. He prepared everything, wanting to control every effect. Even the drafts of his rare talks show marks denoting what words to emphasize, where to change the tone of his voice, where to use nuance. Even in casual conversation, it sometimes seemed each word, indeed each hesitation, was carefully prepared, weighed, and perhaps staged. His personal office, adjacent to his laboratory, reflected focus as well. René Dubos, a prominent scientist, called it small and bare, as empty as possible, without the photographs, mementos, pictures, unused books, and other friendly items that usually adorn and clutter a workplace. The austerity symbolized how much he had given up all aspects of his life for the sake of utter concentration on a few chosen goals. For in digging deep, Avery did not wish to be disturbed. He was not rude or unkind or ungenerous. Far from it. Young investigators who worked under him uniformly became his most loyal admirers. But he burrowed in, deeper and deeper into the world of his own making, a world, however narrow, that he could define and over which exert some control. But narrow did not mean small. There was nothing small about his thinking. He used information like a springboard, a jumping-off point that allowed his mind to roam freely, indeed, to race freely, even carelessly, to speculate. Colin McLeod, like Dubois, a brilliant Avery protege, said that whenever an experiment yielded unexpected information, Avery's imagination was now fired. He would explore theoretical implications exhaustively. Dubois put it another way. He believed Avery uncomfortable in and possibly incapable of handling the chaos of social interaction. But he believed Avery comfortable with and capable of confronting the chaos of nature. Avery could do so because of his uncanny sense of what was truly important and imaginative vision of reality. He had the creative impulse to compose those facts into meaningful and elegant structures. His scientific compositions had, indeed, much in common with artistic creations, which do not imitate actuality, but transcend it and illuminate reality. Years after the pandemic, Avery's colleague and friend Alphonse Daucher received the Kober Medal, an award Avery himself had received earlier. In a tribute, Avery described Daucher's work ethic. He could have been describing his own. Results are not random products of chance observations. They are the fruit of years of wise reflection, objective thinking, and thoughtful experimentation. I have never seen his laboratory desk piled high with petri dishes and bristling with test tubes like a forest wherein the trail ends and the searcher becomes lost in dense thickets of confused thought. I have never known him to engage in purposeless rivalries or competitive research. But often have I seen him sit calmly, lost in thought, while all around him others with great show of activity were flitting about like particles in Brownian motion. Then I have watched him rouse himself, smilingly saunter to his desk, assemble a few pipettes, borrow a few tubes of media, perhaps a jar of ice, and then do a simple experiment which answered the question. But now, in the midst of a killing epidemic, everything and everyone around him, including even the pressure from Welch, shouldered thought aside, shouldered perspective and preparation aside, substituting for it what Avery so disdained, Brownian motion, the random movement of particles in a fluid. Others hated influenza for the death it caused. Avery hated it for that too, but for a more personal assault as well, an assault upon his integrity. He would not yield to it. When Avery experimented, a colleague said, his attitude had many similarities with the hunter in search of his prey. For the hunter, all the components, the rocks, the vegetation, the sky, are fraught with information and meanings that enable him to become part of the intimate world of his prey. Avery had a hunter's patience. He could lie in wait for an hour, a day, a week, a month, a season. If the prey mattered enough, he could wait through an entire season and then another and then another. But he did not simply wait. He wasted not a single hour. He plotted. He observed. He learned. He learned his prey's escape routes and closed them off. He found better and better vantage points. He bracketed the field through which the prey passed and kept tightening that field until, eventually, the prey had to pass through a noose. And he could lay traps, studying pneumococci by scratching it into the skin, for example, where the immune system could easily control the infection, but which still gave him the opportunity to experiment with the bacteria outside a test tube. He advised, whenever you fall, pick up something. And he often said, disappointment is my daily bread. I thrive on it. He would not be rushed. There was pressure on him, pressure on everyone, but he would not be rushed. At Rockefeller, he was hardly the only one devoting all his energies to influenza. Martha Wallstein, who had years before collaborated with Flexner on an unsuccessful effort to develop a serum for Pfeiffer's, was searching for antibodies in the blood of recovered patients. Doucet was making an intensive study of throats. Many others were working on the disease, but they had made little progress. Rufus Cole reported to Gorgas's office in mid-October, "We have been compelled to take care of the cases of influenza arising in the hospital and institute, and these patients have occupied all of our space." Because of the time treating the patients took, he added, "I do not think we can add very much so far to the knowledge concerning the disease." Everywhere, the pressure was intense. Eugene Opie, another Hopkins product who was now a lieutenant colonel on the Army's pneumonia commission, had been at Camp Pike in Arkansas when the epidemic broke out. He had gone there because, during the measles epidemic, Pike had had the highest rate of pneumonia of any cantonment in the country. Now, of course, his orders were to work entirely on influenza. Frederick Russell, speaking for Gorgas, demanded daily a statement of your findings as you interpret them. Every day he was to report. If he found anything that gave the faintest hint of progress, Gorgas wanted to know it, instantly, so it could be shared. Opie would find no shortage of experimental material. Camp Pike held 60,000 troops. At the crest of the epidemic, 13,000 of them would be hospitalized simultaneously. Investigators struggled to find something, anything, that could help, that could contain the explosion. Though no one had found anything certain, in Philadelphia following Lewis's methods, in New York following Parks, in Chicago following those developed at the Mayo Clinic, laboratories were producing enough vaccines and serum for hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions of people. While from Boston, a huge and much publicized shipment of vaccine was rushed across the country to San Francisco. On October 3rd, Gorgas's office in Washington offered all headquarters personnel the anti-pneumococcal vaccine that Cole and Avery had such hopes for, the one vaccine that had been tested, and with such success, that spring at Camp Upton. Even in the midst of this death, this pressure, Avery would not be rushed. More and more reports came in that investigators around the world could not find the influenza bacillus. This in itself proved nothing. It was almost a test of a bacteriologist's skill to grow Pfeiffers in the laboratory. At Camp Dodge in Iowa, for example, bacteriologists found Pfeiffer's B. influenzae in only 9.6% of the autopsied cases. An official Army report blamed them. The low incidence was undoubtedly due to poor technique in handling cultures. Bacteriologic methods of this camp were not to be depended upon. The laboratory chief at Camp Grant, whom Welch himself had pronounced excellent just 3 months before the epidemic struck, found Pfeiffer's bacillus in only 6 of 198 autopsies. Even so, his own report said, "We are inclined to take the stand that this study does not prove the lack of association between the Pfeiffer's bacillus and the epidemic owing to the irregular technique followed." Perhaps that was the case. Perhaps technical errors prevented those at Dodge and Grant and elsewhere from identifying the bacillus. Or perhaps Pfeiffer's was not present to be identified. In his usual methodical way, Avery took the step most likely to settle the question. There was no drama to this step. He poured his energies into perfecting the tool, to find ways to make it easier to grow B. influenzae. If he succeeded, then everyone could learn whether the inability to find the bacillus was because of incompetence or the absence of the bacteria. He filled his laboratory with petri dishes, prepared the culture media in dozens of different ways, isolated the different factors, and observed in which dishes the bacteria seemed to grow best. Then he pushed each element that seemed to encourage growth. A hypothesis lay behind each individual experiment. He had learned, for example, that the pneumococcus inhibited the growth of Pfeiffer's. So he wanted to prevent any pneumococci from growing. He already knew as much about the chemistry and metabolism of the pneumococcus as did any person living. He added a chemical, sodium oleate, to the medium to block pneumococcal growth. It worked. In cultures with sodium oleate, the pneumococcus did not grow, and Pfeiffer's grew better. Over a period of weeks, he made significant progress. Pfeiffer's also required blood in the culture medium to grow, which was not so unusual. But blood serum inactivated the sodium oleate. So he centrifuged out only red blood cells and used them. And his experiments suggested that blood added to the culture at roughly body temperature inhibited growth. Avery found that heated blood, adding blood to media at nearly 200 degrees Fahrenheit, allowed the B. influenzae to flourish. He promptly published the recipe for his preparation, which became known as chocolate agar, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, writing, "It is possible that technical difficulties in the isolation and growth of this microorganism may be in part responsible for the discordant results obtained in different laboratories. The use of this medium has led to an increase in positive findings of B. influenzae in actual cases of the disease and in convalescents." With this information, any reasonably competent scientist could grow and identify the bacteria. At least now they would know that if Pfeiffer's was not found, it was because it was not there. Avery himself still would not be rushed, would not discuss a conclusion he was not yet ready to support. But based on Avery's work, Cole told Russell, "I feel less and less inclined to ascribe the primary infection to the influenza bacilli, although that possibility cannot be excluded until the real cause of the infection is demonstrated. I am very hopeful that the anti-pneumococcus vaccination can be pushed rapidly, while the anti-influenzal vaccination," by this he meant vaccine against B. influenzae, "seems to me still doubtful. We have very good evidence that the anti-pneumococcus vaccination is going to prove to be of a great help." He added, "It seems to me the influenza epidemic gives an opportunity for developing this in a way that could not have otherwise been done." There was nothing easy about making either the antipneumococcus serum, which in tests had just cured 28 of 29 patients suffering infection with type 1 pneumococcus, or the vaccine. It took 2 months to prepare the vaccine properly, 2 months of a difficult process, making 300-liter batches of broth, and the pneumococci themselves dissolved too often in ordinary broth, which meant adding chemicals that later had to be removed, concentrating it, precipitating some of it out with alcohol, separating out the additives, standardizing it. Avery and other Rockefeller investigators did make one important advance in production. By adjusting the amount of glucose in the media, they increased the yield tenfold. But they could still move only 25 liters a day through centrifuges. It mocked the need. In the meanwhile, the killing continued. Part 8. The Tolling of the Bell. Chapter 26. While science was confronting nature, society began to confront the effects of nature. For this went beyond the ability of any individual or group of individuals to respond to. To have any chance in alleviating the devastation of the epidemic required organization, coordination, implementation. It required leadership, and it required that institutions follow that leadership. Institutions are a strange mix of the mass and the individual. They abstract. They behave according to a set of rules that substitute both for individual judgments and for the emotional responses that occur whenever individuals interact. The act of creating an